Welcome to DAC Beechcroft's Lawcast. I'm Joanne Bell, a legal director and knowledge lawyer in the Employment, Pensions and Immigration team, and this is the final episode of our series of four podcasts about the Employment Rights Bill. Today I'm joined by partners Louise Bloomfield and Tim Gooder, and we will be talking today about the bill's proposal on atypical working and ending one-sided flexibility, which in particular will cover the changes in relation to fire and rehire and zero and low hour contracts. But just before we get onto that topic, we've had a couple of recent developments which I wanted to flag, and I think it's fair to say that as this bill is going through Parliament, it's being subjected to some quite detailed scrutiny. So first of all, we've had the Regulatory Policy Committee's opinion, which deemed eight of the impact assessments on some of the bill's proposals not fit for purpose. And so we think this may lead to the government redoing the impact assessments or even to some compromise on the bill's proposals. The other development we had is that the government have already published some amendments they wish to make to the bill. In fact, we've had 53 pages of amendments, so some quite detailed amendments. But when we had a look at them, many of the amendments are to technical details, which won't impact as much. But one very key change is a proposal to extend the time limits for making employment tribunal claims from 3 to 6 months. And whilst this was something we were expecting, it is a significant change nonetheless. So bearing that in mind, we've got a long way to go really before we know exactly what is going to come into force. But we are going to talk today about what we know so far, and in particular focus on some of the proposals which the government will want to push through. Okay, so if we move on to the first topic, that of fire and rehire, the practice of fire and rehire has been described by the government as something which must be abolished. And this is certainly one of the flagship issues addressed in the bill. But Tim, are we actually getting a ban on fire and rehire?
Thanks, Jo. So that's a really interesting question. And the answer is not quite. So it will be the case, though, that employers' ability to fire and rehire employees or fire and replace employees is going to be severely restricted. So first, it's worth having a quick refresh of what the current law says. So where an employer decides to dismiss and offer re-engagement on new terms, the reason for dismissal will generally fall within what's referred to as SOSR. So that's some other substantial reason. And if the fairness of the dismissal is then challenged in the employment tribunal, the employer has to show that the reason is a substantial one. So this will typically be something maybe financial or practical. The employer also has to show that it acted reasonably in dismissing the employee for that reason. So this is what's known as the range of reasonable responses test, and tribunals don't usually delve too deeply into the employer's reasoning here. So as things currently stand, employers do often manage to successfully defend these kinds of unfair dismissal claim. But the bill is going to put an end to all of that. It's going to make it automatically unfair to dismiss an employee for refusing to agree to a change in terms or when the employer intends to replace them with another employee on varied terms to carry out what is substantially the same role. So it's worth bearing in mind that this could potentially apply in the context of redundancy exercise, where a pool of individuals who are at risk of dismissal are required to reapply for a smaller number of roles, and at the same time the employer seeks to change the terms applicable to those roles. So this really could have a significant impact.
Okay, thanks, Tim. But do you think employers could not just get around this by relying on contractual variation clauses, which give them the power to unilaterally to change employees' terms and conditions?
Yeah, that's right. It does seem like a really good option, doesn't it? So actually, thinking about it, it's possible the bill might be amended to introduce controls on the use of those kinds of variation clauses just to make sure any abuse is prevented. And more generally, it's worth mentioning that variation clauses are already interpreted quite narrowly. So even if that isn't addressed in the bill, those sort of clauses won't provide any kind of get out of jail free card.
Okay, I see. And then is there any other exception the employer could rely on then?
Yes, there is. It's only a really very limited one though. So the dismissal would not be automatically unfair if the employer can show that the change was to address financial difficulties that would affect the employer's ability to run the business as a going concern or otherwise carry on the business, and these more extreme consequences couldn't reasonably be avoided. So the government's next steps to make work pay document states that this is intended to allow fire and rehire, but only as a genuine last resort. So making changes simply to improve efficiency won't meet the requirements for the exception that I've just mentioned.
Do you think this is going to have an impact on any of your clients, Tim?
Well, as it happens for me, I don't think so too much anyway, because I mostly advise clients in the health sector. So fire and rehire isn't really commonly used. And it's particularly rare in the NHS. So for our NHS clients, where terms and conditions, so such as Agenda for Change, they're nationally agreed anyway. But what about you, Louise? Is it going to impact any of the clients in the sectors you advise on?
I think it probably will, actually, Tim, to be honest with you, because it's, you know, we act for a lot of businesses in the retail and hospitality industry who've got, you know, large workforces in a challenging sector and a sector that's always diversifying. So if you think about retailers, you know, incredibly transformative in terms of, you know, digitization of what they do, how people shop, their costs are increasing, particularly post the recent budget, you know, managing that against consumer spending, and just the general way in which the retail environment is. So if businesses are in a position where it, part of that modernisation needs to be driven by changing terms and conditions, and the only exception they've got is if they've got extreme financial hardship, it's really potentially going to stifle their ability to make those changes. And they may only be minor changes as well, you know, aimed at increasing productivity or growth or profitability, as it may be, or just making some tweaks to roles. And if they find themselves unable to do that, that could be particularly detrimental. So I feel like it could have a fairly seismic impact in sectors such as retail and hospitality, as I've said.
Yeah. And I mean, that exception to sort of say that it's got to really address financial difficulties is going to be, obviously, as we say, quite difficult to satisfy. But if an employer does manage to persuade the tribunal that that exception applies, does that mean they're home free at that stage, Tim?
No, not even then. There's still more to consider. So, firstly, I just want to flag that in relation to the exception, assessing an organisation's financial viability, it isn't really normally something that employment tribunals are called upon to do. So I think it's likely to take them quite far outside of their comfort zone and also outside of their area of expertise. But saying that, assuming it is satisfied that the exception does apply, the tribunal will then have to consider whether the dismissal is fair on those normal principles. So in its considerations, the tribunal is going to have a think about things like the extent of any consultation that the employer has carried out. So that's both collective and individual. Anything that they're offering in return for the variation. And there may be other matters also that are specified in the coming regulations that we just don't know about yet.
Yeah, and just on that consultation point as well, it's worth flagging that the statutory requirement for collective consultation, so that's where there's a proposal to dismiss more than 20 employees, we normally think is just a thing for redundancies, but it does obviously apply in this fire and rehire space because it's dismissal and re-engagement. And, you know, as your listeners will remember from our first podcast, the bill proposes to remove from the legislation the reference to those dismissals being at one establishment. And so what it means is that employers are potentially going to have to conduct collective consultation where they're proposing 20 or more dismissals across anywhere in their organisation. So that means adding together redundancies and possibly dismissals to effect change as well at the same time. And that could be for completely different reasons. So let's take a retailer, for example. It's closing a store up in Sheffield and it's making some changes to its head office on terms and conditions. And then there's pockets of little bits of redundancies here, there and everywhere dotted around. You've got to pull all those things together. So what it's likely to mean, in practical terms, if this part of the bill also goes through, is that statutory collective consultation is likely to be triggered much more frequently. So if you want to know more about that, I would recommend you go back and listen to that first podcast just to kind of add, you know, put the two points together and see where the potential difficulties and challenges may arise.
Yes, absolutely. And we can access those podcasts on our website as well. Thanks, Louise. So if we move on now to another of the most talked about proposals in the bill, namely the 0 hours contract provisions. So when they were in opposition, Labour declared that it was going to ban exploitative 0 hours contracts, as it referred to them. But that message seems to have changed a little bit over time. What does the bill actually provide for in relation to 0 hours contracts, Louise?
Thanks, Jo. So it's probably worth starting with a quick reminder about 0 hours contracts themselves. So currently, where an individual is on a 0 hours contract, the employer doesn't have to provide any minimum number of working hours. And the employee is also free to refuse work if it's offered to them. So the only protection as we currently have in the law is that there is within 0 hours contracts a prohibition on exclusivity terms, which means that you can't write into a 0 hours contract to say you're not allowed to work for another organisation whilst you're on our 0 hours contracts. If such a clause exists, it's unenforceable. Obviously, 0 hours contracts are common. They're particularly common in the gig economy, you know, delivery drivers, but also a lot of hospitality businesses, also retailers, agency staff. But actually, you see quite a lot of it where people use 0 hours contracts to fit with their lives. So student populations during holidays, parents where they want to work when children are at school, but then have the summer holidays off or whatever. So they are commonly used. And they give people that flexibility. But the converse and the criticism that's arisen is that it's, in some circumstances, potentially at the expense of job security. So what we're not getting with the Employment Rights Bill is a ban on 0 hours contracts. Instead, what's going to happen, as it stands, is that if a worker meets certain eligibility criteria, the employer will have to make them a guaranteed hours offer, which the employee can then choose to accept or reject. But it's also worth pointing out that this change to 0 hours contracts isn't just about 0 hours contracts. Within the bill itself, it also talks about low hours contracts. So some employers offer minimum hour contracts, say they guarantee an employee 4, 8, 10 hours a week. It's possible that they are also going to be caught by this change to 0 hours contracts, but we don't know how low the government is going to define what low hours are. So if the threshold is very low, say 3 hours a week, it won't necessarily have too much impact, and you'll essentially lump those that kind of level of low hours contract together with the 0 hours contracts. But if the government sets that low hours threshold higher, say 12 hours a week, then the impact could be really significant. So, and it would apply to a lot more people. So we're waiting to see what direction of travel that definition of low hours is going to go.
Okay. And you mentioned, Louise, that the employer will have to make them a guaranteed hours offer. What exactly is that? What is a guaranteed hours offer?
Well, there's still some more detail to come, but essentially it's going to be an offer either to vary the employee's existing contract or to give them an entirely new contract. And how that's going to work as we understand it today, and it's obviously all subject to consultation and change and things, but what we think is going to happen is the offer of a new contract to the employee is going to have to reflect the number of hours actually worked by the employee in a reference period. It's not clear what the term reflect means, but we think it's likely to mean that the employer is going to need to base the number of hours offered on the average number of weekly hours the employee has actually worked over a reference period. We think that reference period is likely to be 12 weeks. So, for example, if the contract guarantees the employee at least 3 hours of work a week, or is a 0 hours contract, just take that as our base for the purposes of the example. But in practice, when you look back over the prior 12 weeks, that individual has actually worked on average 10 hours work a week, then the duty to offer a guaranteed hours contract would be triggered, and the employer would have to offer them a contract to reflect those working hours, which will probably mean them offering them a guaranteed contract of 10 hours a week. Albeit, it is possible that the requirement might be set slightly lower. So it might be that it could be you can offer 80% of those average hours worked over the reference period. So that would mean, in that example, offering a contract for 8 hours a week. And that's one of the details we're still waiting for. What we do know is that generally the offer can't be less favourable to the individual. So, for instance, the employer won't be able to guarantee the number of hours but reduce the hourly pay rate for those hours. The bill also is going to give the government power to make regulations that require a guaranteed hours offer to set out the days of the week and the times of the day when the employee will be provided with those hours of work, which will have to reflect when the worker worked those hours in the reference period. And then just to add a little bit more complexity to this, that offer is going to have to be made within an offer period, the length of which will be specified in regulations.
Yeah, that's really helpful, Louise. And just to add to further complexity, if in case we didn't need any. So it's really important also to flag that there could be some kind of ongoing cycle of offers in amongst all of this. So if you take this kind of a step at a time, if an employee starts off on a 0 hours contract, then at the end of the reference period, the employer makes them a guaranteed hours offer that reflects the hours they've worked during that reference period. Then the employee accepts, but the number of hours they are now guaranteed still falls within the low hours definition. Then, if during the next reference period they actually work more hours than their guaranteed hours, at the end of that reference period, the employer must make them another guaranteed hours offer to reflect the hours they worked during that reference period. And this cycle continues until the employee no longer qualifies because their guaranteed hours exceed the threshold or their employment ends. So hopefully you're still with me. And that all does sound really complicated, and it will be quite difficult to keep track of it in practice. And this means that if you have a large number of 0 or low hours workers, you really need a system to record how many hours they're actually working. And if they're working more than their contract provides for, then you'll end up having to make them a guaranteed hours offer and possibly further offers in the future if they continue to qualify as a low hours worker and regularly work more than their guaranteed hours.
Okay, thank you, Tim. Yes, it's certainly not straightforward, is it, one of these provisions? Okay, and obviously, of course, you mentioned, Louise, while a lot of zero and low hour workers might want to have a guarantee of additional hours, there's some who actually do prefer the flexibility that comes with that 0 hours or low hours arrangement. And the government have recognised this, I think, now. You mentioned earlier that the employee is able to either accept or reject a guaranteed offer. Is there a particular process set out in the bill for the way in which they do this?
Yeah, there will be, Jo. So once an employer's made that offer of a guaranteed hours contract, the employee must choose whether to accept or reject it. And they must decide within a specified response period. But we don't know what the length of that response period is going to be yet. That will be set out in the regulations. The regulations will also specify any particular formalities for acceptance. And that's going to be particularly relevant for large employers who have a number of their staff working on zero or low hour arrangements, because effectively you're going to have to manage this, and it's going to pertain to each individual worker as well. And you're potentially, as Tim has said, be on a constant cycle of looking at this every 12 weeks. So obviously, if someone doesn't accept the offer within the response period, that will be treated as a rejection. But again, it's just monitoring and managing that, and things will crop up like, well, what if they're absent, or what if they're sick? You know, how are we going to deal with that? And hopefully this will all come out in the wash in due course. But it has its complexities. One thing to say, though, obviously, if somebody does accept this new contract, that doesn't mean that they're a day one employee again. They will have continuity in their employment, and that ending of the prior contract's not treated as a termination for unfair dismissal purposes. So if someone does accept a new guaranteed hours contract, they can't then bring a claim for unfair dismissal for what happened previously.
And what sort of impact are you thinking this might have in practice, Louise?
Well, you can probably sense from, you know, what I've said and what you've said, Tim, the admin behind this is going to be pretty significant, especially for large employers who will have multiple sites and management teams running effectively different sites, stores, restaurants, well, whatever it may be. So it's going to need a lot of training to get this implemented as well, because it's a big shift. But it's also actually, you know, a sort of shift in where we might see sort of resourcing models as well. So, for instance, we may well see a reduction in the use of 0 hours contracts. That could be as a result of people accepting guaranteed hours. Or actually, employers might say, do you know what? We don't want to use these contracts anymore, these 0 or low hours contracts, because if we've got to go through this admin cycle for each individual every 12 weeks, it's just not worth our time or resource and effort. So we might see a shift away from how employers of using these think. They might even not use them at all. They might also use agency workers more as well. You know, if you've got short-term bursts of the need for extra resource, like over Christmas, over Black Friday, you know, peak times of the year, then that might be where we might see a move towards. So what's interesting at the moment is that there is actually a consultation which closes on the 4th of December about whether these changes to 0 hours contracts should actually apply to agency workers themselves. So we might even see a shift in how agency workers are dealt with. So I think it's really interesting about what employers may use for their resourcing. And what we might also see, sort of my thinking on it, is for those peak times of trading, we might see just a greater use of fixed term contracts. So employers taking people on just for the peak for a defined period of time. Once that's ended, the contract comes to an end. And that, I think, we'll probably see a shift in that direction as well.
Yeah, and you mentioned seasonal variations and things, and that's a good point, isn't it? Because we know clients in sectors such as hospitality and retail are going to be particularly concerned about that. How will this whole regime apply to seasonal work? And I mean, does the bill actually provide this, or is the government sort of given any further explanation in relation to that issue?
Yeah, no, it's still quite unclear at the moment. About seasonal work, because we can see that, as I've said, the guaranteed hours offers potentially causing difficulties for clients and in sectors where there is significant fluctuations in demand, depending on sort of times of year of trading. So in retail, for example, you may well have a very busy period in the 2 or 3 months leading up to Christmas, but then a much quieter period immediately after the January sales. So the question is, you know, as a retail employer, are you then obliged to make your offers of guaranteed hours to 0 and low hours workers that reflect the high hours that those individuals may have worked in that busy trading period, when you know that you're not going to need that level of work in the period that's got lower trading conditions. So there are some limited scenarios where the bill's provisions do allow the employer to offer a fixed term guaranteed hours contract where it's reasonable to do so. And that will be thinking about things like specific tasks, specific events, temporary needs. That's where, you know, you need the worker to come in and work those hours for a temporary period of time. And you'd have to be able to justify that. So that would presumably allow an offer of a fixed term for an annual one-off event, such as, you know, the seasonality of Christmas. Even thinking about Christmas itself, given it's literally around the corner, thinking about an agricultural harvest in the farming industry, for example, where, you know, there's a crop, we need everyone to come in and pick it at that time. Once that crop's been picked, that work's come to an end. But the language in the bill is not at all clear, actually, what sort of seasonal fluctuations would apply in sectors like retail and hospitality, where the demands go up and down throughout the year, where it kind of fits into those scenarios of those kind of one-off tasks or one-off periods of time. And I think that's where we'll see a lot of challenge, in particular by those in hospitality and retail, through the consultation process, which will be coming in 2025.
Yeah, I think you mentioned, Louise, that the point about agency workers as well, and there's just so much uncertainty there. So I think I was right, you mentioned that the consultation's due to end in a couple of days on the 4th of December. I think I've been hearing that there's lots of opposition to extending these provisions out to agency workers. So, not least because they've already got separate protections anyway, haven't they? So that's a bit of an issue. And also agency workers often value their own flexibility and their ability to work in multiple different roles as well. So I think all of this uncertainty remains, and there's a risk that businesses may be asked to give guaranteed hours to agency workers, which overall is going to have to be another blow to those who rely on a bit of a flexible workforce.
Yes, that does really sound like quite a lot for employers to manage, especially when it comes to keeping track of the hours that zero and low hours employees actually work for them, and then to determine whether they have to make the guaranteed hour offers. But that's not all the government is proposing when it comes to ending what they refer to as one-sided flexibility, is it, Tim?
No, don't worry about that. There's more changes to come, absolutely more. So a good example is going to be notice. So there's a new proposed system. It's intended to ensure that workers are going to get reasonable notice of any shifts they have to work. So that's going to protect them from having their shifts changed or cancelled at short notice. And they'd actually get compensation for any shifts that have been cancelled or curtailed without the required reasonable notice. So the government sees these sort of protections as necessary, understandably, because of the impact on workers of shifts being changed or moved. And thinking about those who may be in scope for these provisions, obviously they're going to apply to 0 hours contract workers themselves, but there may also be a broader category of worker. So those where the employer is required to make some work available, doesn't specify the days or times. So it could include maybe shift workers, those with variable work patterns. And the bill's also including powers for regulations to specify that the provisions only apply to contracts below a maximum salary or maximum number of guaranteed hours. So it's unclear, at this stage at least, what these amounts are going to be, but it shows that the driver is to protect those low-paid workers and those in particular with unpredictable working patterns. But again, as currently drafted, the shift work provisions also don't apply to agency workers.
Okay, and looking a bit more closely at the right to reasonable notice of shifts, what details do we have on how that's going to work?
Yeah, we do have some information, actually. So where the employer requires or requests a worker to work a shift, the employer will have to provide reasonable notice of that shift. A notice of a shift is defined as including, so, the length of the shift, the day and the time as well. And the bill's introducing a presumption that notice of a shift is not reasonable where it's less than a specified amount. Although what that amount will be hasn't been confirmed yet, so we'll have to see how that's set out in the regulations. And then the duty to give reasonable notice of shifts will not apply where the worker themselves suggests working a shift, or maybe a longer shift, and the employer agrees. And then sitting alongside this right to reasonable notice of a shift, there's going to be a right to reasonable notice where a shift is to be cancelled or changed. Again, there's that presumption that the notice is not reasonable where it's less than a specified amount. And then finally on this, the duty to give reasonable notice of a cancelled or changed shift is going to apply where the worker suggests working a shift or a longer shift and the employer agrees, but the employer subsequently goes on to change or cancel that shift.
Okay, and the bill also refers to a separate right to compensation, doesn't it, for a short notice shift cancellations. What's that and how will that operate, Louise?
So as it stands and what we know today, the bill is going to provide a right for individuals to receive a compensation payment each time they have a qualifying shift either cancelled, moved or curtailed at short notice. As for what is a qualifying shift, that detail is due to come out within regulations in due course. However, the bill does indicate that which shifts will qualify may be limited by reference to a maximum payment received under the contract or number of hours being guaranteed under the contract. So it sounds like these provisions are designed to protect those on low pay or low guaranteed hours. What short notice is going to be and when it will be treated as being given is also to be specified in regulations. However, the bill confirms that short notice itself will not be greater than 7 days, which, if you think about it, is not really very short. I mean, it's a week, and I mean a full week, not just a normal Monday to Friday working week. So in some industries, 7 days is actually quite a long period of time. So it's going to potentially catch quite a lot here in what is used in industries where their flexible resource is incredibly flexible. And that's the point of why they have them. So that 7 days is pretty long in my view. And what's going to happen is if an employer fails to pay compensation as required, then the employee will have the right to make a claim in the employment tribunal. And if that claim is upheld, then the tribunal will order that the employer pays the amount owed for that shift.
Yeah. And if we step back for a moment and look at enforcement of these rights we've been discussing, what recourse do employees have if their employer doesn't comply with the requirement to offer guaranteed hours or they don't provide the necessary notice of shifts or they don't provide the compensation for the short notice changes?
Yeah, so effectively, we can sort of move into the tribunal space here. So if an individual feels that they should have been offered a guaranteed hours contract or the offer made to them doesn't actually reflect the requirements of the legislation, you know, effectively what the average hours worked were over the prior reference period, or when we're dealing with shift cancellations, they've failed to provide reasonable notice of the cancellation or the change. In all of those scenarios, what you're effectively looking at is individuals bringing claims in the employment tribunal. And the amount of compensation that a tribunal can order will be just and equitable to compensate for any financial loss. It will be subject to a cap. Again, we don't know what that is. That will be come out in the regulations. And it also will be subject on the individual mitigating their loss too. So to avoid double recovery, where an individual's received compensation from the employer for short notice shift cancellations or changes, they can't also bring a claim for failure to give reasonable notice of the cancellation or changes. There's going to be a new right as well for workers not to be subject to a detriment in relation to all of this. So they can't be treated less favourably by the employer if they have accepted, rejected or proposed to do the same in respect of a guaranteed hours contract, or where they've declined to work a shift where they had reasonable belief that the employer had failed to comply with the duty to provide reasonable notice, or where they've brought a claim against the employer to enforce any of their rights under those provisions. They're all fairly common concepts in terms of, you know, workers being able to enforce a detriment claim where they feel like they've been less favourably treated for doing something in response to, you know, something they're allowed to do. There's also going to be protection from detriment where the reason for that detriment is that the worker is entitled to, or the employer believes they're entitled to, a guaranteed hours offer. And there's also going to be a new class of automatic unfair dismissals. So it will be automatically unfair if the sole or principal reason for dismissing somebody is because they've done something in respect of these new bits of law. So either accepted or rejected a guaranteed hours offer, or the employer's sought to avoid its obligation to make a guaranteed hours offer and has actually dismissed the employee in those circumstances, they'll be able to bring a claim for automatic unfair dismissal as well.
Okay, thanks, Louise. So it's clear really that there's a lot of detail, I think, that still needs to be worked out, both in relation to the guaranteed hours offers and the rights around reasonable notice of shifts and compensation for short notice shift changes. Tim, have we got any idea of when we can actually expect these provisions to take effect? And also, I think, what steps, if any, we think that employers might be able to take at this stage to prepare themselves for these provisions coming into force?
Yeah, well, I suppose, thankfully, time frame-wise, that they're a good distance away. So the government has said it doesn't expect these provisions to take effect before 2026. So there obviously needs to be some pretty extensive consultation before we move forward. And given how much detail has been left to the regulations, I think we're probably going to be looking at the end of 2026 for this one. In terms of steps, well, one proactive step employers probably should be taking at this moment in time is to have a think about their workforce and carry out an audit, making sure that they know exactly how many workers they've got engaged on 0 hours contracts, and also contracts with a low number of guaranteed hours, just to make sure they can understand to what extent they might be caught by these provisions when they take effect. And it's also really important to assess what systems you've got for managing shifts and shift changes as well, just to make sure that they're sufficiently sophisticated and there's effective systems are in place.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Louise and Tim. These are obviously some pretty complicated proposals, so it's been really helpful to dig into them with you today. Now, as we've discussed, there are a lot of details still to be fleshed out on these topics, and we'll be keeping our clients updated over the coming weeks and months as the bill progresses through Parliament and when we have some more consultations, and certainly when the draft regulations are published. But for now, thank you both, and thank you everyone for listening.